certain specific foods, vegetables and fruits as food groups, seem to be associated with better mood. Why would that be? Well, because they go down your esophagus, into your stomach, then into your intestinal tract, where there are bacterial colonies waiting. And the gut microbiome determines in large, to a degree, your mood and in many aspects of brain function.
This is episode 109 of the Neuro Experience podcast. I'm Louisa. I'm your host. Hormones, diabetes, mood disorders, endometriosis, and the value of eating a plant-based diet. I'm joined today by Dr. Neil Barnard, the American nutrition researcher, author, and health advocate. Dr. Neil's work promotes a plant-based diet and has been featured in the vegan documentaries What the Health and Forks Over Knives. His upcoming book, Your Body in Balance, explores the new science of how hormones are wreaking havoc on the body, a solution that improves health and reduces pain and sheds weight. An MD, an advocate of improving health from the inside. Let's go.
J-Lo. 1500 threads in my linen sheets. Look like you're missing waking up next to me. Staying relevant is the only shit I'm focused on. Like yesterday, you forever in the past.
Dr. Neil Barnard, I'm so happy and excited to have you on the podcast. Thank you for coming to the Neuro Experience. I know a lot of my listeners are fans of you. I am a huge fan ever since I saw you in the 2017 documentary. We're going to go into that and go into your new book. We're going to talk about hormones. We're going to talk about health. We're going to talk about vegan versus an animal-based diet. But I'm going to hand it over to you and can give us a brief background on who you are, what you do.
Great. Well, thanks for including me. I'm a medical doctor trained at the George Washington University School of Medicine, did my residency there, moved to New York and was practicing in New York for a while before I decided to return to Washington to start this group called the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, which does nutrition research on a variety of areas, promotes healthy diets, especially plant-based diets, and tackles ethical issues in research. And we've been busy and there's a lot left to do.
There is. That's incredible. You first caught my attention with Forks Over Knives and What the Health. Now, I want to get into, first and foremost, you talk a lot about the fact that you don't eat animal products. Can we go into that and tell us why?
Sure. Not eating animal products is a good choice for any number of reasons. From a health standpoint, animal products have cholesterol. They have a lot of bad fat or saturated fat in them. What that means is that they are linked to cardiovascular disease. They're also linked to higher rates of cancer. They are linked to diabetes and many, many other health issues. And the good news is that when people get animal products out of their diets, that many of these conditions are not only preventable, but to an extent reversible. In 2003, the National Institutes of Health funded my own research team to try to improve on the dietary treatments for type 2 diabetes. And we decided to use an entirely plant-based diet, and it turned out to be 300% better than the best current diet for what we would call glycemic control or blood sugar control in people with type 2 diabetes. And of course, there are obviously other non-medical reasons for not eating animal products. Climate change is a huge one, although many would argue that that's a medical reason too, because climate change affects our health. The ethical issues, I think, are as important as they ever were. And in my own life, I grew up in North Dakota, and my extended family always raised cattle, and they still do. And I hunted as a kid, and so I know what it's like to shoot your own dinner. But I have to say that as we mature, we start to realize that maybe these things are not necessary. The animals suffer enormously in the process of being turned into dinner. And I think that it's a mature choice to decide not to be part of that anymore.
It's so interesting because what I've seen is ever since the documentary Game Changers came out, so many people have started to adopt this vegan lifestyle because I remember a distinct scene in there where they got the blood
from, you know, three different people, and they showed how, I guess, how cloudy, how cloggy it was if you were having meat in your diet. And then so a lot of people, without even knowing the science behind it, a lot of people just switched immediately to a vegan diet. Now, there's a lot of controversy, and a lot of our listeners on here don't have a medical background. Some of them do. So I'd love to take a deep dive into the science behind it, but also address exactly what it is that we're affecting. Because I did have somebody on here, I think around 6 months ago, who adopted a all meat diet where it was like he only ate meat and no plants, and it caused a lot of controversy. And I love, you know, talking to doctors such as yourselves and really understanding the pros and cons of both sides of the story. So I think in your perspective, when you look at, are we looking directly at hormone levels associated with meat eating? Are we looking at, are we looking at longevity?
There are many, many things that you can look at. You can certainly look at what kills people. Do you have a heart attack? Do you have cancer? Do you have diabetes that ends up being fatal? And generally speaking, people who follow plant-based diets do better in all of these. But because that's a really long research study to see what to wait for you to die of a heart attack, we usually look at intermediate measures, like what does the diet you eat raise your cholesterol? Does it expand your waistline? Does it affect your digestion in an adverse way? And all across the board, plant-based diets are better in all of these ways. And part of this is maybe even a little bit obvious if people back up a little bit and think we're not dogs or cats. Cats are, in fact, carnivores. And a human being is in the category of great apes. Our biological cousins are gorillas and orangutans and chimpanzees and bonobos. And they are largely or exclusively herbivores. They eat huge amounts of fruit. They never eat ice cream. They don't eat Spam. They don't eat hot dogs. They don't eat any of those things. And to go on an all meat diet for a human being is as ridiculous as, say, for a cat to say, well, today I'm going to eat brown rice and that's all I want. It just doesn't relate to your fundamental biology. And in the same way that if you put the wrong fuel in your car will not run well. If you have a car that takes unleaded and you put in diesel fuel, it's not going to go very well. And everything's going to go wrong. The exhaust will be wrong. The ride will be bad. The mileage will be horrible. Everything's bad. If you put meat into a great ape, things start to go wrong. Now, people are adaptable because over time, the human species started out in Africa, moved north, went over the Bering Strait, ended up in very cold climates. And so we found ways to biologically adapt, at least for short-term survival, to a wide range of foods. But those desperation attempts to keep yourself alive should not be mistaken for good health.
Wow. It's what I've been interested in lately is whenever you're switching from diet to diet, or you really want to get a, you know, a thorough understanding of your own body, I always like to determine, you know, I go back to science. I don't think that anybody should be really turning to a vegan diet or a carnivore diet or whatever diet without first understanding what's happening in their body. And that first starts with standardized blood testing. Maybe they get a cortisol test. Maybe they get a hormone test. I recently did 23andMe, and I'm starting to do all that for myself and really get into the biohacking space and understanding my body first before I eliminate things from my diet. So do you think that that is a good measure for people to start getting on the right track?
Many of the people that we see just want to get better. They've got diabetes. They've got diabetes that's out of control. They're a typical American adult is overweight, and they would actually do very well to adopt a vegan diet, and they don't necessarily need testing in advance to do so. If they do have a medical professional, it's certainly good to watch how your numbers improve, but there's no hazard to following a healthy vegan diet. And when I say vegan, I don't mean a person from the planet Vegas. I just mean a person who doesn't eat animal products. And so it consists of four food groups. Those are vegetables, fruits, whole grains, and legumes, or I might say beans. And you should take vitamin B12. It's essential. And if a person who's got weight problems does what I just described. And if they keep oily, greasy foods low, in almost every case, they're going to lose weight. If they have diabetes, in almost every case, they're going to get better. If they have high cholesterol, they're going to improve. And all of these things can happen. And over the long run, their risk of cancer and of Alzheimer's disease is very likely going to get better as well.
So in your practice, do you do any type of like testing, like pre and post a specific diet?
Well, we have a regular primary care facility, so people come in and they have a full range of laboratory values. And we also do clinical trials where we bring in people and we practically turn them inside out. And that's to be able to show what diets do. So, for example, we recently did a test comparing a Mediterranean diet to a low-fat vegan diet. And so for that, we test your metabolism and your cholesterol and your blood pressure and many, many things far beyond what you would do in a normal clinical setting. But the thing that I want to be clear about is that people really should be encouraged to follow a low-fat vegan diet, whether they're doing specific testing or not, because there isn't anybody with genetic characteristics that mean that you are suddenly a cat. You are a human being, and human beings do well with fruit and vegetables and things. These are the things that should make up a healthy diet. The reason that I'm emphasizing that is I don't want to put obstacles in people's way. We want to make it easy for them. And I don't want them to be frightened that maybe a vegan diet isn't for me. There's a lot of nonsense out there. There was a book by a well-meaning but I think ill-informed author called Eat Right for Your Type. And the idea was that if you're blood type A, that a vegan diet might be good for you. And if you're blood type O, you needed meat. And I have to say, he's just wrong. In our research studies, most of the people are blood type O, but they don't do well with meat. If you put them to a vegan diet, they do well just like the type A's.
So where did that notion come from too? Because I've seen a lot of that. I've seen many books that is eating for your blood type.
Yes. The truth is that there are slight differences in disease risk based on blood type. Type O's have slightly less cardiovascular risk, but that doesn't mean that they should eat spam or bacon. The fact that something has made your risk a little higher or a little lower. Let's say there are genes that affect your risk for lung cancer, for example. Some genes make it less likely. Some genes make it more likely. Tell me a blood group that ought to smoke. Tell me a blood group that ought to be exposed to asbestos or radon in hopes that they don't get cancer. There's no reason to expose yourself to these risks. Mm. But I have to say, everyone loves a new idea that maybe I'm special. Yeah. And unfortunately, some of those things are, well, really not very well founded in science.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think a lot of people are looking for their way out in the easy way out. You know, like I want to be not just thin and healthy and slender. I also want to be able to move well. I want to feel athletic. So if this is what everyone's talking about now, this is exactly what happened after the release of the documentary. Everybody just went straight into a vegan diet. And I was actually asking people, I'm like, why are you doing that? They didn't know the reason behind it. They just did it, which actually scares me because it's like everybody's now susceptible to marketing, which means that if somebody puts out the carnivore only diet and they put a lot of science and literature behind that, then people will start to adopt that. And that's why I love, really digging into the science behind it.
Now, yeah, it's true.
Your upcoming book, Your Body in Balance, The Shocking New Science of Hormones and How They're Wreaking Havoc on the Body and the Delicious Solution that Improves Health, Reduces Pain, and Even Helps Shed Weight. Can we get into that? And can we really like take a helicopter view and understand first and foremost, what are hormones? And then we'll go from there.
Sure. It's a really exciting new frontier. Hormones are messages, really, almost like a letter that goes from one place to another place. So, for example, your pancreas makes insulin. Insulin is a hormone. And it gets into the bloodstream and it goes out to the cells of the body to help them absorb sugar out of the blood to use for energy. Or your thyroid, which is at the base of your neck, makes thyroid hormone that goes out to the cells of your body to give them energy. Or a woman's ovaries make estrogens. Estrogens are female sex hormones that cause the uterus and the reproductive anatomy to get ready for reproduction. And a man's testes make testosterone that go to his brain and I guess make him want to run for president. So we have, just getting there. We have hormones of many different kinds that are messages from one place to another. But the reason I wrote Your Body in Balance is that if you have too little of a certain hormone, you don't do well. If you have too much, you are not going to do well. And we need to get into balance. And the range of conditions affected by this is astounding, from, say, estrogens, menstrual cramps, endometriosis, hot flashes, hormone-related cancers. The same is true for men with regard to something like prostate cancer. Moodiness, skin changes, energy, how our skin and hair look. All of these things are under hormonal control, and nobody has a clue how to do it. So the science is not yet finished, but I wrote this book to show what we know and to show how people can get behind the driver's seat, get their hormones in balance, and feel better.
Wow. Okay. So first and foremost, if we want to go and get a hormone test, what do you suggest? Because I know you can do a lot of at-home ones now, right?
Well, that's actually, I'm suggesting something a little bit different. Let me give you an example. A young woman, and this is a real example, young woman called me up and she had terrible pain. You know, most women have, or many women have, a bit of menstrual discomfort, but for maybe 1 in 10, it's off the scale, I cannot function type pain. I am not going to work today type pain. And a young woman called me up. This is what she had. She said, I got a business trip tomorrow. What can I do? And I said, well, I can give you painkillers for a couple of days, but if this happens every month, let's see if we can get you into balance so it doesn't happen anymore. How do we do that? And I suggested something to her that I don't think any doctor had ever suggested as a treatment for menstrual pain. I said, how about this? For the next 4 weeks, no animal products in your diet at all. And I want you to avoid added oils, minimize oils. So what I had effectively done is dramatically increase the fiber content of her diet and greatly reduce the fat content of her diet. And it turned out to be a flat out cure. She didn't have any pain the next month or the next month or the next month. And so, I then did a randomized clinical trial with a large group of women, and we showed that it works. It changes, it reduces PMS, bloating, mood changes, and pain. And in the course of this study, I want to tell you, we asked all the participants to not use any hormone medications like birth control pills, because that would confound the study. So if they were sexually active, please use some other kind of contraceptive method. And one of the women in the study said, don't worry about me. She and her husband don't use any contraception because she's infertile. They were evaluated years earlier and it wasn't him. She said, it's me. I don't ovulate. I'm infertile. We don't use contraception. We don't use the pill. We don't use anything. Don't worry. The second month that she started on the vegan diet, she came into our center and she said, Dr. Barnard, I have some bad news and some good news. And I said, well, what is it? The bad news is I'm leaving your study. The good news is I am pregnant. And she gave birth to a healthy baby and then a second baby. And then she had a third baby. Here's my point. The first woman who had menstrual pain, she did not have a chronic condition. She was out of balance and could get back in balance. The second woman who thought she was infertile, she wasn't infertile. She was out of balance. So you don't have to go get tested. You don't have to measure your estrogen level. What you have to do is simply do the diet changes and then let nature take its course.
Wait, so you didn't even, when the first girl came in and said she's got menstrual cramps, you didn't even test her hormones to start with. You just changed her diet. Wow. How did you know that that was going to be effective?
I didn't know. No, there'd never been a study on it. It was just an educated guess. It's a little bit more than that. The reason I say educated guess, first of all, I should say there's no harm in using a low-fat vegan diet, so the intervention was not harmful. And I gave her painkillers so that she was going to be okay for now. But the reason I thought it would work is that I had remembered some very good research studies on women with breast cancer. When women have breast cancer, if they have a high estrogen level, that's going to make their cancer spread or progress. And women who don't have breast cancer, if they have a high blood estrogen level, they're at higher risk for developing breast cancer. So I thought, okay, estrogen makes things grow. And we knew from these research studies for cancer prevention that if you reduce the fat content of the diet and you increase the fiber content of the diet, the amount of estrogen in your blood gets back down into balance. The excesses are reduced. And there are some physiological reasons for that that I can explain. But the point being, as this poor young woman was talking to me about her miserable pain, I thought, okay, let's ramp up fiber. Let's reduce fat. It works for breast cancer patients. Maybe it'll work for you. And if we reduce the estrogen in your blood, then there will be less thickening of the uterine lining next month, and you won't have so much pain at the end of the month. That was my guess. Mm. And it was true. But until our team did it, we never had any research studies on it for this application. And so we published our findings in Obstetrics and Gynecology. And yet still to this day, gynecologists don't generally tell women about it. They say, let me start you on the pill or go get ibuprofen. That's the treatment of choice. And so you go into any drugstore, there isn't any notice about going vegan to cure your pain. Instead, it's buy Motrin, buy Aleve, buy non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs.
So when we're talking about anti-inflammatory drugs, you know, like ibuprofen, whatever you want to take, it's the loop that we go through. Okay, so obviously you secrete cortisol. Cortisol is a stress hormone. Now, what is the relationship between food and then that hormone cortisol? Because I know there's a massive loop. I know that norepinephrine is involved in it, and how are we, and I was just reading a study about the levels of cortisol, you know, how high they are in, like, when you first wake up and how low they are when you go to sleep, and getting into cortisol testing. So if the idea here for some of this is to lower cortisol levels, do you know the relationship between cortisol and food?
That actually has not been an area of our research, and I don't think that that's really the issue for, say, a young woman who's got the condition that we call dysmenorrhea. In this case, it's a little simpler from that, and she might actually feel quite serene and fine and not be under stress. You know, as you know, cortisol is a stress-related hormone. She might really feel quite fine, and not, she may have just won the lottery. She's not under any stress at all. Everything's fine. But what happens is that the ovaries make estrogens. Yeah. And the liver has a way of eliminating excess estrogens. And the way it does it is the liver takes the estrogens out of the blood and it sends them down a little tube called the bile duct that leads from the liver to the intestinal tract. So your liver takes the estrogens out of the blood, sends it down into the intestinal tract where it's carried away with waste. Mm-hmm. But if you don't have fiber in your diet, then the estrogen is not trapped in the intestinal tract. It doesn't go out with the waste. It ends up being reabsorbed back into the bloodstream. And so it circulates around. And so you have too much estrogen just circulating around and around and around and around in your bloodstream. The minute then you increase fiber, that stops and you excrete this excess estrogen. So on a vegan diet, everything you eat is from a plant. Everything you eat has fiber. Fiber is plant roughage. And so if you had a salmon fillet, that's not from a plant. It doesn't have any fiber at all, and that interferes with your estrogen metabolism. But as soon as you're on a healthy vegan diet, there's loads of fiber in your diet, and that gets you help. That's part of the road to getting back in balance.
Interesting. Okay, so you mentioned earlier the hormone insulin. Okay, can you talk about diabetes? Because insulin, it's a hormone made by the pancreas. And obviously, you said it allows your body to use glucose from carbohydrates, et cetera. What is diabetes? What's type 1 and type 2?
Okay, diabetes means that there's too much sugar in your blood. And insulin is made in the pancreas, which is a little organ right behind your belly button. And the insulin goes from the pancreas through the blood to the cells of the body, and it acts just like a key. It actually stands on top of the cell, and it like a key, it opens up the cell to allow glucose or sugar, if I can use that word, glucose sugar, to get into the cell and power it. So sugar or glucose is actually a very good thing because it's your cell's very favorite fuel. But here's the problem. if for some reason the insulin arrives at the cell and the key doesn't work, if the insulin key is unable to open that cell, then the glucose builds up in the blood and it doesn't get into the cell. And so you feel tired. So you don't have your fuel for your muscles. And as blood sugar, as the sugar builds up in your bloodstream, it can cause all kinds of havoc. And so type 1 diabetes means that the pancreas doesn't make insulin anymore. And type 2 diabetes is much more common. The pancreas still makes it, but the cells don't respond to it. The key just can't open the cell. And here's the new part. And if anybody is sort of listening to this program with only half an ear, I want you to listen with both ears right now, because what I'm going to say is important. The cause of type 2 diabetes is that there is a buildup of microscopic fat particles inside your cells that are interfering with insulin's ability to work. So in your muscle cells or in your liver cells, microscopic fat particles, they're too small for you to see. They are inside the cells. They are building up and building up and building up because of what you've been eating. And as they build up, insulin can no longer get that cell open, and so it can't get the sugar into the cell anymore. And so then people say, well, then if I eat sugar, then the blood sugar level will rise. Or if I eat bread, which digests to release sugar, my blood sugar will keep rising. That's all true, but that's not the cause of the diabetes. The cause of diabetes is the buildup of fat inside the cells. It means that that sugar can't get in anymore. And that's why a low-fat vegan diet works, because there isn't any animal fat in it at all, and there's very little vegetable oil. If you keep that low, the fat drains out of the cells, and then the insulin can now work again to open the cell up and get the sugar out of the blood into the cell, and you've got a shot of greatly improving the diabetes or even curing it.
Wow, so you can actually reverse type 2 that we're talking about right now. So you can be diagnosed, you've got type 2, and here are the different solutions that you can take. Here's a medication, or here is a vegan diet, or here is, you know, you can take all these different solutions to actually reverse type 2 diabetes.
Correct.
Wow, that's so good. What about someone who's been diagnosed as pre-diabetic? What does that mean?
What that means is they have exactly the same problem. But they're at an earlier stage where their blood sugar hasn't risen to the point where they're going to be diagnosed with diabetes. But if a person with type 2, if a person with pre-diabetes begins the same diet I just described, which is not a hard diet, it's much easier than old-fashioned diabetes diets, they will very likely no longer have pre-diabetes, and their likelihood of progressing to type 2 diabetes drops like a stone. So I would recommend that anybody who has type 2 diabetes or is concerned about it, they should adopt a diet that has no animal products, keep oils really low, make sure you take your vitamin B12. I recommend that for everybody. And you are going to do very, very well in most cases.
Okay, so in your new book, do you talk about mood disorders?
Yes, and this was another case. I hate to sound a little bit like an explorer going through the jungle trying to find solutions to things, but that's kind of how it's felt. This was an accident too. We were doing a research study with one of our huge car insurance companies called Geico, G-E-I-C-O. Geico is a huge car insurance company in the United States, and their national headquarters is right near my office. And they had 2,500 people in their headquarters, and many of them were overweight or had diabetes. So we instituted a vegan diet at work, and it helped. We had healthy foods in the cafeteria and a weekly class, and people, their diabetes got better. If they had overweight, they lost weight. But we also noticed something else, that we tracked depression scores, and they got better. There's standardized testing that you use, and we found that people were getting better. And we looked at anxiety scores, and those improved too. And at first we thought, well, you're losing weight, you're feeling more energetic, you're on this great vegan diet. If you got diabetes, your blood sugar, your numbers are better, you're probably reducing medication, maybe that's the reason you feel better. And I think that's true. Yeah. But there seems to be more to it than that, because other researchers have found certain specific foods, vegetables and fruits as food groups, seem to be associated with better mood. Why would that be? Well, because they go down your esophagus into your stomach, then into your intestinal tract, where there are bacterial colonies waiting. And the gut microbiome determines in large, to a degree, your mood and in many aspects of brain function. So if you put pork and beef and chicken and fish into your digestive tract, you get certain bacterial colonies that survive. And if you put vegetables in there, you get other bacterial colonies that survive. In other words, a vegan diet helps your gut microbiome and that feeds back to the brain.
Wow. You know, it's that's a huge topic that a lot of people really want to dive into, because we're looking at increased people being diagnosed with depression. And something that I'm very open about is, you know, some doctors, some MDs out there, and immediately just giving an SSRI to the patient and just not even dealing with it from a functional perspective. Maybe different if you go to a DO, but so that's the first thing. Anxiety right now, if you look at how many people are actually experiencing anxiety on a daily basis, is just through the roof. And I've always loved to look at the correlation between food and mood disorders, such as the ones that you just described. So everything now that I'm talking about is just, everything that you're talking about is pointing to a vegan diet. And I know that it's just like anything that I feel like I'm going to ask you, you're going to be like, well, these are the studies and this is why you should turn to a vegan diet. So I think you've got me hooked right now.
Well, you know, there's some truth to that. And I would say two things, though. There do have to be certain adjustments to it. A plant-based diet is good for everybody. There's never a reason not to do it. But there are certain adjustments to it. For example, when I started off talking about cramps, menstrual cramps, the woman who I mentioned did great on a vegan diet. But if she added oily foods, I mean, even plant oils, she didn't do nearly as well. And what we have, so vegan is great, but you also want to keep it low oil in her case. Or if you have thyroid disease, you want to make sure you're getting adequate iodine. And so there, I'm going to say, if you're not, bring in sea vegetables, like a nori roll or something like that, or iodized salt if you want to use that. But so there are certain differences in emphasis. It's not exactly that it's always the same prescription. However, it is very much like the car analogy I mentioned earlier, that if you're putting meat and dairy products and eggs and a lot of sugar and junk and grease into your body, many things are going to go wrong. You're going to feel worse mentally. Your cholesterol will rise. Your waistline's going to expand. You get all these problems. So getting away from that is kind of job one. And then beyond that, we can refine it from there.
Okay, so we've touched a lot on hormones and its relation to women. Can we move over now for a short segment and talk about men? And I know earlier you mentioned, I think you mentioned certain hormones related to prostate and colon cancer. Can we go into that?
Yeah, actually, let me make a big pitch for just what you said earlier about the need for the medical profession to thinking about non-medication solutions. So many men go into the clinic for erectile dysfunction. And the guy kind of hems and haws and he says, I'm having trouble with my nature. And he has all kinds of euphemisms. Sooner or later, the doctor recognizes he's asking for a Viagra prescription. And so the doctor can write a prescription for an erectile dysfunction medication like Viagra or Cialis. And the patient takes the prescription in his hand. He says, thanks very much. And he walks out the door. But if the doctor is a good doctor, the doctor runs after the patient and says, stop, we're not finished yet. You know, could you please come back in? I need to tell you something really important. And the doctor then looks the patient in the eye and says, the reason that you have erectile dysfunction, it's not that you have stress or performance anxiety or any of that kind of stuff. The reason that you have erectile dysfunction is that you are not getting adequate blood flow to your private parts. And the patient looks at him quizzically and says, what are you talking about? The doctor explains to him that the male sexual anatomy, if I can refer to it this way, is sort of a hydraulic system, that if there's not good blood flow, it does not do its thing. And so a man who has erectile dysfunction in midlife has narrowed arteries. What has happened is he's been eating ham sandwiches and hot dogs and hamburgers and pepperoni pizza and cheese. And as his blood cholesterol levels have risen, the cholesterol has been irritating his arteries. And it irritates the artery wall, causing small plaques to form that are like blisters on the inner wall of the artery. And that's happening throughout his body. But the penile artery is pretty small anyway. So if you have atherosclerosis in the arteries leading up to that, then you can shut off the blood supply really easily. And so what the doctor says is, if you have atherosclerosis in your private parts, that's what these plaques are, atherosclerosis, then you have it probably in the coronary arteries to your heart. And you probably have it in the carotid arteries going to your brain. So if you have erectile dysfunction now, that's a sign that you're at high risk for a heart attack or stroke within the next 4 to 5 years. So have Viagra if you want to, but that doesn't reverse any of this. And the doctor should then explain, I want you to see a dietitian, because there's only one diet that reverses those blockages. And that is a diet that eliminates the animal fat and eliminates the cholesterol. So at this point, the guy says, all right, I want to do a vegan diet, not for diabetes or for, I don't get menstrual cramps, I'm a man, but I'll do it now because I don't want to, you know, I want to open my arteries up again. And one of the common side effects that we see in men who go vegan is that their erectile dysfunction stops and they can function sexually again. And that's, of course, was the centerpiece of the Game Changers movie that showed people quite accurately that sexual functioning is determined in great degree on what you had for breakfast.
Wow. This is what makes me very mad when people just like turn to pills. And it's a very controversial topic because I feel like it's more of a band-aid method rather than really addressing it from a functional perspective. Like you're saying, it's just here's a band-aid method and let's just see what the little blue pills do and go for gold. So thank you so much for clearing that up. How about something like prostate cancer or...
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, so important. It's
prostate cancer. Yeah.
Exactly. Very, very important. Prostate cancer used to be said to be due to old age, and every man's going to get it if he just lives long enough. That is not entirely true. If you look around the world, there are really quite large differences in prostate cancer incidence, and it follows dairy products. There are many different contributors, but dairy products have really risen to the fore because dairy in countries have more prostate cancer. Countries that avoid dairy tend not to have it. And so in the United States, at Harvard, researchers did a study called the Physician's Health Study. They brought in 21,000 doctors, and they were the research subjects. And they tracked what they ate. And it turned out that the men who ate the most dairy products had a 34% increased risk of prostate cancer. Compared to the men who generally avoided them. And so they then did a follow-up study. This had more than 60,000 people. It was called the Health Professionals Follow-Up Study. And in this one, the men who consumed the most dairy had a 60% higher risk of prostate cancer. And other studies have been done, and you put them all together. There was a 2016 systematic review that said overall the dairy-consuming men have something like 43% higher risk. So why would this be? Dairy products, obviously milk, comes from a cow's udder, and it's designed to help the calf grow. It has no other purpose. That is its purpose. And in the cow's bloodstream, in the bloodstream of the calf, you will detect a compound called insulin-like growth factor that greatly increases the more milk the calf drinks. And if you are a human being, and you're 55 years old and you drink 3 glasses of milk, your insulin-like growth factor will rise as well. Take insulin-like growth factor, put it in a test tube, add prostate cancer cells to it, and you discover they grow like crazy. It's a growth factor. Put breast cancer cells in the same test tube, same story, they grow. So milk is designed to sustain and support very rapid growth. And that's why weaning is universal. I don't care if you are a human being or if you are a cow or if you are a horse or a bull or a raccoon or whatever you might be, every species is to be weaned because milk is a dangerous thing beyond the age of weaning. It's very powerful nutrition for a growing baby, but it should not be consumed after that.
Wow. Damn. So what does a day in the life of Dr. Neil consist of when it comes to nutrition?
You mean what foods do I choose?
Yeah.
A huge variety. I have to say, I grew up in North Dakota, and the diet there consisted of roast beef, baked potatoes, and corn just about every single day. except for special occasions when it was roast beef, baked potatoes, and peas. And that, you know, it was a very limited diet. But now I live in Washington, D.C., and so there's everything. So if I go out to dinner, it might be an Italian meal, but instead of the Alfredo sauce on my spaghetti, I might put the arrabbiata sauce or marinara sauce, or, you know, some tomato-based or wild mushrooms or something like that. Or, and then, of course, they have lentil soup and minestrone and beautiful salads. And, or I might go Chinese, where there are rice dishes and tofu dishes and vegetable dishes. Or if I were to go to a sushi bar, I would not have the fish sushi, but I would certainly have the cucumber roll or sweet potato roll or asparagus roll and miso soup and seaweed salads. Or there's a Thai restaurant right down the block where they have practically everything on the menu has a vegan option of it. Or Mexican is a favorite of mine, where I wouldn't have the meat taco, but I'd have the bean burrito with jalapenos, you know, no cheese, but or maybe veggie fajitas or something like that. And so what I do is I avoid animal products and I keep oils really low and I try to eat natural kinds of foods. And if you told me I can't have any of these foods anymore, I have to just give it all up and go back to North Dakota and eat roast beef, baked potatoes, and corn, I would have to say that's a very unappealing diet. I will also tell you that we, in our medical center, we have, it's called the Barnard Medical Center in Washington, D.C. People come to us and they've been all on all kinds of diets. If they had diabetes, they were on a diet that restricted carbohydrate and made them count calories and count carb grams, and they hate it. They say that diet is so tedious and I was hungry all the time because they were trying to starve the weight off me. And they find a vegan diet to be perhaps surprisingly easy, because you're not counting calories, you're not limiting carbohydrates, you're eating as much of that as you want. You're just making some shifts to the better product.
Wow. I absolutely love this. Can you, thank you so much for sharing everything, especially in detail. You are incredible. I think you've switched myself and everybody onto a vegan diet. Where can we find out more about you? When, wait, has the book been released yet?
Yeah, it's a week old. It's your body.
It's a baby.
It's called Your Body in Balance. And let me brag about this for a minute. When we did the recipes, Your Body in Balance is about hormones. So we start with sex hormones and getting them in balance. I will talk about thyroid hormone. So if you're wondering why you're gaining weight and feeling rotten, let's get your thyroid back into balance. We talk about insulin. We talk about mood, skin, everything. But then the recipes were all done by Lindsay Nixon. And Lindsay Nixon is on, you see her online as the happy herbivore. She's a genius when it comes to making recipes that don't have very many ingredients and are quick to make, but really delicious. She sent me 65 of them, but she sent them with a note that I actually put in the book. Her note said, "Dr. Barnard, I didn't tell you this, but the way of eating that you recommend cured my own cramps." And I thought, okay, well, that's an endorsement. So many people suffer from things that they never talked with anybody else about. And they feel so much better when they do this. So anyway, Your Body in Balance, it's on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and Target, and, you know, all the online places. But if there's a surviving bookstore in your own neighborhood, I hope that people will give them their business.
Oh, 100%. And where can we find out more about you? Are you a social media guy?
Our website is PCRM.org. That stands for Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, PCRM.org. And PCRM is on social media, and I am as well. My name is Neil, N-E-A-L, Barnard, B-A-R-N-A-R-D, Neil Barnard. And you'll see me on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and all over the place.
Oh, thank you so much. Hopefully we can get you back on here in the future. But other than that, thank you so much for being part of the Neuro Experience.
It's been great to talk with you today.